Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome back to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. We are going to be talking about mental health today. Yes, I know we've been talking about that a lot, but it is on the hearts and the minds of families all over the world. And we are grappling with a mental health challenge like we have never seen before. And there are so many aspects of this to unpack. I mean, everywhere I go, when I do media, I'm often asked, is the mental health crisis as bad as people say it is? And it's important for me as a nurse, as a trusted source of health information, to say the truth. And I tell them, no, it's not as bad as you think it is. It's infinitely worse. And I think that's because of a lot of different reasons. It's because we're living in a world that's going at the speed of a smartphone. It's because of the detrimental impacts of social media on young people today. And it's because of just the social and cultural stressors that we are feeling. It's because we live in a world that is very politically divided, and there is a lot of conflict and strife that is going on. There are many reasons for it, and we want you here to feel empowered, to be able, most importantly, to promote your children's mental health and your family mental health, and to adopt practices that will be preventive in nature. That is my heartbeat as a nurse practitioner. But we also want you to be able to recognize things early and to be able to intervene early as well. Those things are important. Now, yesterday we talked with a social worker, Dr. Holly Oxhandler, and a really interesting conversation about the intersection of faith and therapy, not just mental health, but therapy, and how is our faith woven into that? Well, today we have another academic colleague. We're just going to nerd out for you here, and I'm not even sorry about it. But today's guest is Dr. Jennifer Lundgren. Now, she is a committed believer who loves God's word, and she is also a licensed marriage and family therapist. She has more than a decade of experience in treating patients on the brink of burnout. And she has a passion for helping people become the best version of themselves, which is the version, of course, that God created us to be. She teaches at Minnesota State University and is looking forward to her next project, which is studying international drug policy in Portugal and Switzerland. So I, as an academic myself, I am an advocate for human trafficking policy. So Jennifer, I'm so glad to talk to a fellow academic and a policy wonk. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jessica. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you today, too.
I am. I think this is a conversation that I'm having everywhere I go. People saying, you know, is this generation too soft? Do they just need to be tougher? Are we on the brink of disaster? I mean, all of these questions that we're worrying about. And you started talking about this, of course, this topic of mental and emotional wellness, it sounds like at the beginning of the pandemic, and have written a book called A Guide to Mental and Emotional Wellness, Biblical Wisdom, Practical Principles, and Clinical Insight, which just sings my song and just sings right to my heart. And so I'd love to start, Jennifer, by just telling us a little bit about yourself. What's your story? Who you are, how your family came to be, and what role faith has played in your life journey?
Sure. Yeah. So as you mentioned in my bio, I'm a mental health provider, and I'm also a professor. So what I really love to do is teach people how to help other people. And I kind of say that my mission is to really support those who serve others. So along with that, I also have four little children, not teenagers. I'm not sure which is more challenging. But I met my husband in college, and I got married the summer between my master's degree and my doctoral program. And then I had my first child while I was finishing up my doctorate. And then I've had three since then. So I have four kids, age range of 2 to 9. And I think that was really what prompted me to write the book, is just even though I've studied mental health, even though I work supporting other people with their mental health challenges, I was just realizing that I needed more tangible tools. And not only that, I needed tangible tools that also had a biblical base, because in the psychology world, I just wasn't finding that. It was either like the Bible and prayer and kind of like religious coping. And then it was psychology and all of the other kind of evidence-based type resources. So I really wanted something that blended both of those worlds for me. And that was kind of how the book came about.
Well, I am also a mom of four, a little ahead on the curve. My kids are now 20, 18, 16, and 14. So maybe that's a debate we can have, toddlers versus teenagers. You know, what is more difficult? And I think in those early parenting years, I heard a quote once that said, the longest days and the shortest years are when your kids are young. And I think that is so true, because I remember thinking,
yes,
I am never going to make it to bedtime tonight. Like, it's just not going to happen. And then, Jennifer, I hate to tell you, but they can become teenagers, and then they don't have a bedtime. Life gets even sleep deprived. But it is, there are definitely challenges at every stage. And one of the things that I love about your platform is that we have the same heartbeat as clinicians and moms and people. And it's interesting, because in other academics or professionals that I've talked to, we have access to all of these professional tools, which there are some great tools out there. But I cannot emphasize an amen enough to say it's not enough. I had all of those, and yet I was failing as a mom. You know, I had four kids in 5 years when I was doing my doctoral program and all of those kinds of things. But, you know, and so I was learning, but I needed that biblical base. I love how you said that. Now, in your book, you share pretty candidly about your journey as a wife and a mother and balancing your professional life. So tell us about that moment, sitting on the edge of your bed, fighting a wave of panic and anxiety, and what changed your life at that time.
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of funny. I almost say like that was the moment that something shifted. But it was in August of 2019. So it really all was pre-COVID. And I was anticipating my maternity leave ending with my third baby. And I think my other two were not even going to school yet. So I had two others at home and a new baby. And fall semester is always really busy. And I just like was filled with like this dread and almost despair of like, how am I going to do this? I can barely survive while not working. How can I add that to my plate as well? So not only did I have three little kids, I also was seeing clients as a therapist. And then I was in a big year. I'm a tenured track. So I was working towards tenure at the university, like a bunch of projects and needing to publish and do all of these different areas, criterias for this promotion. And I just was like, I need to change something, because this isn't a sustainable model. And it's at that point, it's like, well, one option is to do less, right? Like I could quit my jobs. I could, you know, put my kids in childcare for 50 hours a week and, you know, kind of go extreme on either end. But all of the roles that I have were just too important to me. So I just said, I think my one alternative is that I have to take better care of myself. And I need more information about how to do that really sustainably. Like, you kind of know the basics of what you should be doing and maybe not actually do it. But it's like, I needed more, because not only was I filled with these feelings, but I also had this idea of like, I don't want to be in survival mode. And I don't think I need to be. Like, I think there's a way that I can thrive while doing this all. And I'm going to figure out what that is. And that's kind of what started my journey of just doing a lot of research. And then I proposed to present at a conference that was in April of 2020. And I proposed in October. And it was like helping providers thrive in a weary world is what I called it. And who would have known that between that time frame of proposing this conference and actually presenting it, the world literally shut down. Everyone was home. The conference went online. And I think from that point on, I've just really been talking about leading workshops and to educators and mental health clinicians and parents. And then the faith component was infused into it. So it started out from a secular perspective, And even that wasn't sufficient. So that's when my worlds blended. And that was because of all those presentations is really when the book came about as well.
Well, I think that, you know, that is a really fascinating thing and so relatable, because it doesn't matter if you're a parent who is working, you know, there are parents who cannot quit their job, like it's not financially sustainable for their families. But there's also parents who are stay-at-home parents, but who are have more than a full-time job, because they're being the soccer mom and the PTA president and, you know, whatever else it is, the volunteer jobs that the working parents don't have time to do, and they're doing all of those things, or dads who are carting their kids around to sports as soon as they get home from work. I mean, I think we talked about this yesterday with Dr. Holly Oxhandler, just that I think we can all agree that we are too busy and we do need to look at our calendar. But at the same time, the concept of self-care is so important, and burning the candle at both ends and sacrificing our mental health, our emotional health, our spiritual health is not okay. But self-care gets a bad rap, honestly, doesn't it, Jennifer? I mean, people are so resistant to it.
Yeah.
They're tired of hearing about it. Like, but the bottom line is that our kids need us to be our best selves. And we're not talking about, okay, now parents, you should take a 3-day retreat in Tahiti and put cucumbers on your eyes, you know, and don't talk to your children. We're not talking about that. We're talking about basic things like eating well, exercising regularly, managing your stress in a healthy way. And those are all the things that are like, eat your vegetables. Who wants to do that? So why are people resistant to this? Why is it so hard for us to do?
Sure. Yeah, it is. It is funny. I think it almost needs to be rebranded in a way. We need to call it something else, like wellness strategies. I don't know. I haven't come up with a good alternative, but I think people are resistant to hearing about it because it makes them feel guilty, right? Like, yes, yeah. I know. And it also makes them feel overwhelmed. And I don't think we don't have like a unified definition either. So some people might say, yes, I know I need to work out. I know I need to eat better. I know I need to budget better and call my grandma, all of these things, but I can't, right? Like I am not able to do that right now. So it kind of gets this reputation of you have to do more to take care of yourself. And I really wanted to challenge that idea of like, how do we integrate all of these practices into our already busy schedules instead of adding them on? Because that's a really different model. I think that's much more approachable. The other thing I think about it gets a bad rap from a Christian perspective, because I think Christians think that self-care is selfish, and they have a belief that other people need me more, that I don't have time to do that, I don't have money to do that, and that's not what, like, the ethos of a Christian is service to others and to God, not to self. So that's where that kind of unified definition comes in. It's because it gets this idea of you have to be extravagant and you have to be you focused instead of other focused. And that's where I kind of wanted to change that conversation, is having a you focused, your cup is full, so you can more wholly and completely and sustainably serve others and be others focused.
Well, that is a way to reframe it through a Christian ethos, is that we want to give our best selves to our kids. And not only do we want to do that, we're really called by God to do that. And when we aren't taking care of ourselves, and not in a way like treat yourself, like you talk about in the book, you're talking about ways that are really going to nourish our own mental and emotional and spiritual health. And, you know, the scripture does say that our body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, and we have an obligation to take care about that. I can't wait to talk to you more about doing that in a guilt-free way and incorporating it into what we're doing. And when we come back, we're going to talk about our thoughts. I'm going to give you some brain science here that's going to be fascinating. But in the meantime, we are giving away a copy of Dr. Longren's book to the first caller at 888-589-8840. That's 888-589-8840. First caller will get a guide to mental and emotional wellness, biblical wisdom, practical principles, clinical insight. And when we come back, we're going to talk about metacognition, cortisol, and dopamine. You don't want to miss it. We'll see you on the other side of this break.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hey, friends, and welcome back. We are talking to Dr. Jennifer Lundgren, who is the author of A Guide to Mental and Emotional Wellness, Biblical Wisdom, Practical Principles, and Clinical Insight. Now, we have been talking about the concept of mental health and self-care, and I want to read you one of the opening paragraph of her book. It says, "It can be overwhelming to watch the news or a Facebook news feed and see what people are talking about. It's disappointing and alarming to read the headlines and see what is happening in our country. Wars, rumors of wars, drug overdoses, murders, disease, and not only the acceptance, but the promotion of things that are clearly against the Bible. The world is struggling, and along with it, our mental health is struggling, and depression and anxiety rates have skyrocketed. Suicidal thoughts are occurring now in children as young as first grade. Drug use and self-medication have increased and pose a grave danger because of drugs such as fentanyl that are even fatal with a small consumption. As a Christian, it is easy to become overwhelmed with the way people treat each other. What type of world do we have to leave for our children and grandchildren?" That is the opening of Dr. Lundgren's book, and that really resonated with me, Jennifer, because this is what I'm talking about every day on this radio show, in my community, in my practice. This is what people are worried about, and I think when we see what we are dealing with, and if we really look at what our kids are facing, it is easy for our hearts to be overwhelmed. And so before the break, I promised that we were going to talk about some brain science. And so here we go. We're going to dive in. I want to talk first about metacognition. Now, this is a fancy word for thinking about what you're thinking about. And I've talked about that previously with Lauren Gaines, a psychologist and author who we've had on the show before. And Jennifer, you say in your book that we think about 60 to 90,000 thoughts per day, which is absolutely unbelievable, but we don't often stop to think about what we're thinking about, and then those thoughts drive our actions. So I'm going to give you a quick transparent story, and then I'm going to let you take this away. So, you know, when my stress is building up, I was picking up my kids from school one day, and I felt the stress coming out towards other drivers, and I was not at my best, and somebody cut me off. It was really dangerous, and I really wanted to yell at them, but I make it a practice. I don't say, you know, words. I'm trying to be a guard over my mouth. And I was struggling with what to call because I really wanted to call this person an idiot. I honestly did. I'm just going to say in my flesh, but I didn't. I ended up calling him a gumball. I'm like, you gumball. And so my kids have never let me forget this. They're like, oh, look at that gumball. But it's a reminder to me. I really feel like the Lord put that on my tongue because it is a reminder to me that I let my stress overflow into that. And that is not okay. So tell us about the difference, Jennifer, between complaining and gratitude and what that does to our brain.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. So it's really interesting, just this whole concept of thoughts and just having these automatic thoughts. And a lot of times, especially if you are very plugged into social media, reading the news, we complain a lot and we have exposure to a lot of complaining. I mean, even if you go on a Facebook feed, thankfully I deleted Facebook about 10 years ago. So I feel like my brain has been preserved a lot of cortisol. So cortisol is a stress hormone, as I'm sure you know this, but it's released when our body perceives a threat in our environment. So it's super functional. It's really adaptive. It is how we stay safe and how we survive, is that there's this little dose of this neurotransmitter and our body reacts to help us stay safe. But the issue is, if you're exposed to complaining, if you are on social media, if you're exposed to a lot of fear, it's like this cortisol is being dumped in your brain all the time. It's like these doses that are constantly happening. And even micro stress doses, it's also called, just these mini doses of this neurotransmitter. And the issue is it kind of builds up in our body, and this, our stress response becomes very overreactive. And that's when we might snap or lash out or just feel tense ruminate, have worry, things like that. And that's just as damaging to our body, to our immune system, to our relationships, to our heart health, all of these things. And they found that exposure to as little as 30 minutes a day. Because the other thing about complaining is it can feel really great. It can feel awesome to vent. You know, a lot of us, that's how we connect with other people. If you're in a really toxic job or a really stressful job, what do you talk about? You talk about all the stress and the boss and the clients or the students and everyone who's not doing what they should be doing. And it's almost like a trauma bond. Like we connect over, you know, the people we dislike and the drama and all of these things. So cortisol is flowing in a lot of people. And as opposed to gratitude, your question was, what's kind of the difference? So gratitude releases dopamine. And that's the neurotransmitter kind of addiction. Actually, it's pleasure, but more importantly, it's motivation. So it's, this feels good and I want to keep doing it. It happens when a lot of times when we eat sugar or also addictive drugs like cocaine or heroin. But gratitude also releases dopamine, which is really interesting. So they call it the virtuous cycle, because if you feel grateful, if you are flooded with appreciation, it feels good. And you want to keep feeling that. So you'll have practices and you'll kind of develop strategies to keep that dopamine flowing. So that's really the difference. And that's a totally different profile in our brain and in our body, in our heart. And it truly can be life changing.
Well, that is fascinating. And I was really struck by the thought of this trauma bond happening from complaining together in toxic cultures. And that can happen when you have toxic relationships in your family or through your job or any number of things. I could think of any number of examples. And you talked about how complaining actually lowers testosterone for men and that estrogen is the aggressive hormone. I feel like we need to visit that really quickly.
Yeah, I don't. So if you think about like venting to your husband and just how that, like, it wears them down, and they found that actually lowers testosterone, which is really funny because we always think of like high testosterone men as being like aggressive and lashing out like the Hulk, but it's actually the opposite. It's actually the low testosterone men who have that aggressiveness. So that's a joke that I always make, like, oh, who would have thought that estrogen is the aggressive hormone?
I don't know. I feel like
more complicated than that, but
I feel my husband nodding from here. Like, yes, that wears me down when you complain, but you also talk about, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, but it just, even that's how we can bond with our spouse of like, here's all the things the kids did today and here's what happened at work and here's all the things I'm annoyed with my family holiday planning, right? Like that's kind of how we connect with our significant others as well. So once I heard that, it's almost like being very intentional about what you're talking about even and how you are connecting with people, because it's easy to have kind of like those garbage connections and that garbage conversation. And a lot of people might challenge that. When I talk to educators, they're like, do not take this away from us. Like, we need this. And again, as a therapist, like it's really important to talk about upsetting things and to be really assertive. But I feel like we've taken it to the extreme. And that's just like all we talk about is all of the stressful things. And I don't know if I had this in the book, but I always quote my mom because she would always say garbage in, garbage out. Mm-hmm. And that's, I feel like we have garbage consumption of social media. And then what we spew and what we think about and how we feel is just really impacted by that.
And then you say that people bond by complaining, but that leads to a victim mentality and feelings of selfishness and entitlement. That's not a place we want to be. And I think this is fascinating in the context of what you're talking about. We're still talking about self-care. So in caring for yourself and integrating this in, you're talking about thinking about what you're thinking about, recognizing when you're complaining, and changing that to gratitude. That is a form of self-care. Am I getting this right?
Yep, absolutely. And another piece of that is just being super intentional with guarding your mind, guarding your heart, guarding your focus, even. Like, that is self-care. That is proactive strategies to protect your mental health. Because, you know, it's those benign things that doesn't seem like a big deal. It doesn't seem like a big deal if you call your sister and vent about things or vent about this and that, or just think these, you know, kind of negative, bitter thoughts. But all of those compound, and your body is impacted by that. Your mind is impacted by that. So, yes, as you said, this is all a form of self-care, and it's a form of self-care that's very doable. It's very digestible. It just kind of starts with that intentionality and awareness of where our focus is going.
Well, I'll tell you, as a professor, I'm also very interested in the science of gratitude, and I've been trying to implement this more into my family and talking about, you know, recognizing your negative thought patterns that you say in the book, they lead to fight or flight. And a lot of times that just leaves us frozen. So we don't do anything differently. We just stay in that adaptive state where we have that cortisol. And like you said, it feels good for a second, but then it literally damages our blood vessels and damages our organs long-term. It is not meant to be a state to stay in. And so I've taught my kids, you know, to recognize feeling their stress and gratitude. And even this morning, okay, I was feeling super stressed because I've got a lot going on. I've got girls coming home from college. I'm trying to think about all these things. And my son comes up to me and he just looks at me and I said, no, just no. Even before he told me, he said, yes, yes. And I said, no, I don't want to. And he said, take 3 deep breaths and tell me things you're grateful for. And I felt like a child. I was going to stomp my foot and just say, I don't want to do that. But you know what? He convicted me. He absolutely convicted me. And so one of the things that you talk about, again, another just tip and tool for self-care, is the power of the pause to regulate your body, not making a permanent decision based on temporary feelings. So what does that look like to have a pause when you're feeling stressed and regulate your body?
Oh my goodness. I just feel like sometimes these tools can be so simple, but they are so challenging in the moment. What this is, it's literally stopping and just shutting your mouth before you respond, right? Like there's so many times where in a moment of anger, you might just spew something that you didn't mean to say, or in a moment of frustration, you respond in a way that is just really harsh, really unkind, whether it's to your kids or to your spouse or to a family member, whoever it is. And, or maybe, you know, in kind of more serious situations, if I work with people who have mental health challenges or people with addiction, like that kind of impulsive response out of emotions could be self-harming. It could be relapsing. It could be, you know, doing a very dangerous or maladaptive coping behavior in that moment. So it's just stopping and just not responding at all and giving your body and your brain a chance to activate that prefrontal cortex, kind of get the whole brain back online, and then problem solve from there. But even that's a skill that has to be developed. And it's so profound when you think about it. And I've talked to clients about it, just like if you would have learned this, if they're in treatment and I'm leading a group on this, like what could have been prevented? Whether it's domestic abuse, whether it's a suicide attempt, whether it is, you know, saying something that's irreparable in a relationship, but it can truly be life changing. And it's such a good way. It's a good place to start, even with kids, to help teach them emotion regulation skills.
It's so true. It is. These things are so simple, but they're just not easy to do. And as a society and as people, we just have no tolerance for long-term problems or things that require practice. And we live at the speed of a smartphone and we want this instant fix. And maybe we try it once and we think that doesn't work. But these are things that do take discipline and character. And honestly, Jennifer, that's one of the reasons why I empowered my kids to hold me accountable, because even in my son telling me, tell me the things you're grateful for. I mean, I can hear myself. It's ridiculous. I'm telling him, well, I'm thankful for my family. He's, are you now? are you now, Mom? That doesn't sound like you're grateful. And, you know, having that family activity is so good because where you say where your focus goes, your energy flows, and bad thoughts are reinforced. And I think one of the most common bad thoughts that we have is that we're a bad parent, that we're messing up our kids for life. So how do we disrupt that?
Sure. I think one of the biggest things is just having an awareness, just knowing that, that's what's going on. And that's kind of where that metacognition comes in, that if we're having these negative thoughts that are just automatic, we're not trying to think that, we're not planning on thinking that, they're just coming into our mind. But we disrupt it by gaining some awareness and by starting to notice what triggers that. Is it a certain thing your child does? Is it a certain time of day? Is it your own mental state? What is triggering that pattern for you? And then from there, it's replacing it. And again, this sounds so simple, but I think we have to have an awareness to start. Like, what are we working with? What are our thought patterns? What are some, you know, kind of things that occur again and again and again that bring them up for us, that trigger those in us? And then from there, like I said, having new strategies and also sharing it. And we can talk about that more, but just saying it out loud and receiving support for it is really important too.
Well, we are going to talk more about that. And we are also going to talk about good versus bad emotions. And what are the power of our words in all of this? We'll also discuss some common misconceptions when it comes to mental and emotional wellness and self-care. And we want to congratulate Jeff from Mississippi. And I want to know, my board operator is Jeff, and he's from Mississippi. Jeff, did you call into our own show? Maybe you did. No, okay. But we will be right back on the other side of this break. Don't go away. You don't want to hear the end of this conversation.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, friends. We are talking to a fellow professor, Dr. Jennifer Lundgren, about her book. We're talking about mental health. Her book is called A Guide to Mental and Emotional Wellness, Biblical Wisdom, Practical Principles, Clinical Insight. And we have talked about some brain science of why it's important to have self-care and how you can integrate self-care without feeling guilty for failing and being realistic about it. And the next thing that I promised you we would talk about is emotions. Now, emotions, I think, are highly charged in and of themselves, but we tend to label emotions as good versus bad. And Jennifer, you have a quote in your book from C.S. Lewis that says, "It's easier to say my tooth is hurting than my heart is broken." And what I have said before is that when we have a broken bone, we give a cast. And when we see someone with a broken spirit, we cast judgment. It's like we accept a broken bone, but we don't accept a broken heart because it's subjective. And I think that emotions are a signal to our body that we need to process some sort of experience. And you actually talk about a fascinating study here in your book, a study from Yale, where you had where these faculty members, one group was told to recall a positive experience and one group was told to recall a negative experience. And they kind of sat in the emotional moment of that recollection. And then they graded a paper. And the people who thought of the negative things graded like a whole grade lower than the people who graded positively. And I'll tell you, Jennifer, as a professor, I was thinking, ooh, sorry to my students. Did I grade your paper after I messed up my kids? Oh, no. But talk to us generally about the role of emotions in self-care.
Yes. And I love that study, too, because what's interesting about those faculty members is that they believed they were completely unbiased. So I think, you know, a lot of us think of emotions as being flaky, as being fake. If I were to say to you, I'm a really emotional person, you'd be like, ugh, like you're unstable, right? So yes. Emotions just get this really bad rap overall. But what's so important about them is that if you think about learning, if you think about decision making, if you think about a lot of things that typically we describe as very cognitive, logical processes, there's a lot of emotions at play. Even in connecting with others, emotions are critical. So emotions play a really big role in self-care just because our emotions need our attention. They need our respect, and they need our curiosity. I think a lot of Christians especially just don't do emotions very well. I'm going to be really blunt. And we just think, nope, I shouldn't feel like this if I'm sad. You know, like, I have a savior, I have a wonderful family. If I'm feeling depressed or anxious, like, I shouldn't feel this way. And I think that leads to even more confusion and isolation and despair. Like, why am I still feeling like this even when I have a great life? And the other thing is we feel very ashamed about it too. Like you said, a lot of times we don't want to be judged. We don't want to burden other people. So we really kind of hold it inside of us. So yeah, there's a lot to emotional health that I would love to dive into.
Well, I think that you're right about all of those things. And we are so hesitant to share our emotions because we're afraid of how those are going to be received, how we will be perceived. And honestly, Jennifer, when somebody shares an uncomfortable emotion or a deeply felt emotion, because we all believe that the world is about us, I think sometimes in that moment, we feel like if somebody's sharing with us, like, and we're, especially if it's in the context of a Christian relationship, oh, this is my pop quiz. Do I know the right Bible verse to share? Oh, do I know the right spiritual accolade to say? Like, do I say the right thing? You know, and they say, oh, I'm anxious. And you're like, oh, I know this one. I know this one. The Bible says, do not be anxious about anything, but in prayer, give everything to God. So you should just pray and give everything to God. Oh, did I get an A? Mm-hmm. Instead of just responding to them and seeing that, you know, one of the things I love to talk about is the fact that Jesus had emotions. He was angry. Okay, he went into the temple. He overturned tables and he had a whip. I mean, this was like intense anger. He wept. He was hungry. He was tired. He was frustrated. He was lonely. I mean, all of those things are real emotions. And so how do we manage that? Because parenting, especially, Jennifer, is such a deeply emotional experience. And sometimes we have trouble controlling our emotions. And if we do that, we're not going to model it well for our kids. So how do we manage ours in a way that effectively models that for our kids?
Yes. And that's such a wonderful question. That's such an important question. But it's this idea of like you can't be in the presence of another human and not be influenced by how they feel. It's this concept called emotional contagion. We literally catch the emotions of others. So one big thing is a few just misconceptions is that it's okay to have a wide range of feelings, like you just said, just like Jesus did. So you don't always have to be happy. You don't always have to be high energy. You don't always have to be pleasant. Like, it's a human experience to have the range. And the kind of quote unquote bad emotions have a really important function, like irritability and disappointment. It's okay to feel those. But I think a big thing, with all of this work, be very self-compassionate and non-judgmental. If you're like, oh, you're right, I'm such a bad mom because I always snap at my kids, I'm always angry, I'm always frustrated, you're right, I stink at emotions. Like, nope. I just that curiosity about them of like, how do I feel? And then I just think having an extensive vocabulary is really important for parents and for children. Like you said, if someone has a broken arm, they can get a cast. But if we have, you know, distress or isolation, or if we feel something deeply, a lot of times we don't have the language. And Brené Brown talks a lot about this in Atlas of the Heart. It's like going to the doctor and you'll say, okay, in my knee, it's this tingling sensation. It's a shooting pain. It's really sharp at this point. But we have about three words that we use to describe emotions, right? Like, I think they're happy, sad, and pissed off is the extent of our vocabulary. So just having this nuanced vocabulary is really powerful. And then being able to share them. And I'm not saying like emotes all over the place on Facebook, just let everything out. But if you are in a marriage and you're struggling and just saying, I'm feeling really frustrated, I'm feeling irritable, like, this is what I need from you. this, like, here is how I'm doing. I'm overwhelmed, especially for men. If they can have that vocabulary to share instead of just shutting down, instead of just snapping or freaking out, I think that's it's a protective factor. It's a preventative factor in and of itself, is just sharing it before it snowballs into something bigger and more intense. The yeah. other thing too is just to, once again, to listen to other people and not be afraid to share it. Because so many times, like, oh, I don't want to burden you. You're caring enough. But I've just found in my friendships, the more vulnerable I am, the more deeply I connect with others.
Yes. And, you know, one of the things that you talk about is that sometimes our emotions don't reflect reality. Like, the feeling is real, the emotion is real, but it doesn't mean that it's true. And so you say, if you feel like nobody cares about you, nobody understands you, it doesn't mean that nobody cares about you or understands you. And so sometimes, especially I think when we start using that always or never kind of language, like, oh, mm-hmm. you always give me such a hard time about this, or we never do this, you never listen to me, those kinds of things. And so I think, what do you say about, you know, going back to the biblical truth and looking at, is this true? Asking that question, is it true? And then relating that yep. back to biblical truth. How do we do that?
Yeah. And I think it just kind of takes that, like, it takes that pause and that reflection and just this, like, compassion and curiosity and just, like, that intention to be able to do it. And then also, you know, even if it is true, how would God want you to respond? I don't think he'd want you to, you know, give your partner the silent treatment. I don't think he'd want you to lash out. And really kind of caring for them in a way that God would care for them, and using strategies to help cope, to help change your state, and also to help learn as well. I think emotions, like you said, they're a really powerful signal, and I feel like they have a lot to teach us too. So they're not, it's not like I have this feeling of loneliness and this means that no one cares, no one understands what it's like to be a mother of four and a career person, right? I'm talking to someone right now, but just kind of taking that time, you know, even to pray about it and to reflect on it and to know that even if it feels like that, like, we know God is always with us too. And kind of getting back, knowing that these feelings can also bring us closer to God's word and to God.
Which is what we need as parents, because we need to be able to have that sense of stability and security to be able to give to them. We call this in our professional world, secure attachment, right? The stabilizer that makes a child's emotional mm-hmm. life stable. And if they have, that's the number one predictor of resilience for kids when they experience hard things, is a meaningful connection to one supportive adult in their life. And we have the amazing privilege as parents to decide that that can be us. But I think, you know, when we're wrapping up all of these things together in this delivery, when we're communicating with our kids, when we think about the emotion that we're expressing and the words that we're saying, the language together, you know, it's interesting because you could say the same phrase with a completely different emotional intent or a completely different emotional delivery, and it's going to mean something completely different. And then combining with our nonverbal communication, because, you know, the kid's job is to scan their environment and to look at every single move that we make to feel like they are emotionally safe. And if they feel like we're upset, we're dysregulated, we're angry, or something is wrong, then they intuitively know that. Their mind is like a police scanner working in the background. And the more that mm-hmm. is, the more hyper alert they become to our micro actions and micro cues, because then what you're going to do is then pass over into that realm of unhealthy coping, because they are going to try to regulate our emotions for us. So seeing like, oh, okay, well, mom gets angry, you know, she seems like she's kind of upset, and she gets really upset if the house isn't clean. So I'm going to run through and, you know, clean the house and make sure all the kids stay quiet. That's where that kind of passes over, where our kids are regulating our emotions for us. And that, mm-hmm. I think, is why it's so important for us to practice self-care, because we are literally impacting. This is so hard. This is stepping on so many toes, and I fail a lot. But I think that we need to be cognizant that we are carrying that stewardship as parents. So what other practical tips can you give us, Jennifer, in that, now that we're thinking, oh my gosh, we are messing up our kids for life. I'm about to spin into a negative thought pattern. So what do we do to stop that?
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure.
Well, but to be honest, that was one of my biggest realizations when I first became a parent, right? Is like, it doesn't matter what discipline strategy I use, what I even say. Like, if I'm not okay, nothing I do is going to be effective. Like, if I am angry and melting down and totally in my own mind, I'm not going to be effective. So I just think whatever you can do to stay regulated, whatever it is, there's thousands of ways. My book lines up several. But whether it's pausing, whether it's reframing, whether it's practicing gratitude, whether it's doing all of the foundational elements of just, you know, like you said, exercising and eating well and having friends and having a community, if we're regulated, we'll be much better for our kids to help them work through their own dysregulation. Because if a parent is struggling, has mental health challenges, is struggling with addiction, there's no room for the kids to... There's no room for their emotions. There's no room for their problems, right? And that's why, again, whatever tools that you can use to regulate yourself so you can be present and available for them emotionally so you can help them work through their issues. Another thing that I'm thinking about is just this, with emotions, we just have this ability, we have this desire to fix it. You're sad, let me fix it. I want to make mm-hmm. you not sad. You're overwhelmed, let me fix it. I'll do your homework for you, right? Like, we want to take it away. And just, that's not helping our kids develop resilience. Like, so don't be afraid of emotions either. Listen to them, you know, help your kids feel heard. And once they're regulated, then the problem solving can come in. But I think a lot of parents have this like knee-jerk reaction of like, it's excruciating to see my kids suffer. If they're having a hard feeling, they're suffering, and I need to save them from that. That's not our job. It's okay for kids to experience hard feelings, and it's okay for you to help them work through it. But that's where your regulation is so key at those points as well.
It's so important. And the other side of that coin is, of course, the culture of toxic positivity, like good vibes only. We don't have any negative emotions ever. It's all about balance. And we know that if we think on those things that are noble, that are right, that are pure, that are lovely, that are admirable, that are praiseworthy, God gives us a roadmap in His words to retrain our negative thoughts into positive ones. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer, for being with us. We appreciate you being here for this episode, and we'll see you tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.